Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. I'm happy, very happy, to have Dr. Andreas Westerle back with us tonight. And the subject is going to be the effect of our great and illustrious president, FDR, on world history, including present-day history. So, welcome back, Dr. Westerle.
Thank you very much.
You know, I'm just so pleased to be able to talk with you about these subjects. And something that you said last week at the end of the program has so much meaning for me. And you were talking in answer to my question that Germany, part of Germany's problem in being picked on by all its neighbors and being blamed for everything all the time is that it being a part of the Holy Roman Empire, being the main representative of the Holy Roman Empire for so long, it developed, the Germans developed, a German national character developed a kind of otherworldly, very spiritual quality, and it's just not, they're not hard players in politics, and they're not very good at looking out for their interests. So can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, of course, it's an interplay between the what might be called this facet of the German national character and the location of Germany right in the heart of Europe, you know. So Germany's had to deal in the past with many, many centuries, since the Middle Ages and before, actually, had to deal with France, or as used to be called Gaul, and with Britain in the west, and with the papacy to the south, and with the kingdom of Denmark and kingdom of Sweden to the north, then of course the kingdom of Hungary to the east and kingdom of Poland to the east, and beyond that, the Tsardom or the realm of Russia, the empire of Russia. And all these countries have had a very strong, sometimes deleterious and hostile influence upon Germany for the past over 1,000 years. And at the same time, as you said, that Germany constituted the most important part, together with Italy, the most important part of the Holy Roman Empire. This brought about a kind of spiritual orientation on the part of most Germans, the German national character, which very often, of course, on one hand, it produced the Great Reformation of 1517 and all that, and the Luther and the other great reformers. But on the other hand, it also turned out to be very disadvantageous to German national politics and German unification, and briefly, power politics, because it didn't allow the German politician, German statesman, to focus fully on the question of power politics as, for instance, was exercised by the English, who were very successful and very intelligent about applying power politics for many, many centuries, or the power politics of the French monarchy, and not to forget the power politics of the papacy in Rome.
Would you say the Germans could we use the word naive then, or what, unsophisticated, or not of a mind to look after their own interests properly? Or
not properly, that's right. I wouldn't say unsophisticated, but apparently too much concentrate upon spiritual questions, intellectual questions.
And morality. Because it's my opinion, in everything that I have studied, read, and looked at, that the Germans are more concerned with morality than any other nation in Europe or that they've had to deal with, including the United States. Is that too strong of a statement?
Well, it depends on your definition of morality, but that certainly would be the case, yes. The German people as such has been very strongly oriented towards morality and towards, in the past at least, towards religion and towards spirituality in general, in contrast to other nations, especially the English and the French and the Russians and so on. Of course, at the same time, we cannot forget that Germany has produced some of the greatest thinkers and philosophers and composers and musicians since the ancient Greeks of 400 BC. But we also know that the ancient Greeks became prey of the ancient Romans, and they were conquered by the Romans, and pretty much the same thing has happened to the Germans, at least in the, particularly in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. Well, let's talk about what part Frankie Roosevelt, you call him that, I like that, Franklin Roosevelt played in all of this, taking advantage of the German spirituality.
Well, it's hard to put in a nutshell, but you can probably characterize, of course, I know that there are millions of good admirers who greatly admire Frankie Roosevelt for whatever he did. I don't know exactly.
I grew up being one of them, as I've told others, because my father was a great admirer of him, unfortunately. That I always thought my father was a very intelligent man, and he was, but he fell for that. But that was just the mass consciousness, and they're really trying hard to keep that going. So I'm so glad to find in you someone who will give us a clearer picture.
You can probably say that Roosevelt was a very cunning politician, very crafty, and he certainly didn't cavil at twisting the truth for his own benefit, and that went on for decades and decades when he was working for the Navy and then later on as governor of New York, and then finally, of course, especially as the president of the United States.
Oh, so you're saying that these characteristics are part of him, and they go, you can find evidence of this all the way through his career.
Yes, one might say that, yes. And also, there are various other factors, of course. F.D. Roosevelt seems to be conscious of the fact that he himself was not as intellectually gifted, so to speak, as Teddy Roosevelt, his cousin, various places removed. Teddy Roosevelt was very bright, but at the same time, he seems to have shared a common malady of the entire Roosevelt clan, namely that many of them tend to be mentally unstable, you know.
Hmm.
They're part of, I don't want to say insane, but they're definitely flighty. And that was the case for Teddy Roosevelt, even though he was very bright, but he was at the same time rather exotic psychologically. And Franklin Roosevelt shared in that too, even though he was not as bright as Teddy. He was also a bit off the beam, as were some of his relatives. However, that did not hinder him from being, as I said, being a very crafty and very cunning politician and trying to turn ways to his own benefit. And this was, of course, especially true in his relations with Japan and with Germany, and then finally with the great catastrophe, so to speak, of Pearl Harbor, which he engineered beforehand, even though he outwardly he always proclaimed to be the man of peace, he was actually working towards a war, probably from the outset, off and on, from the outset, since 1933, particularly against the Japanese.
Why did he want war? Why did he prefer war?
That's a very good question. Later on, one of his Republican friends was Stimson, who became Secretary of War under Roosevelt, and Stimson was the Secretary of State under Hoover. And Stimson, together with other parts of the so-called American power elite, C.Y. Mills, power elite, they wanted to keep Japan down because they wanted to expand into the Pacific towards Australia and towards India, I suppose. And they saw Japan as a great competitor in the Pacific region. So they were, from the very start, were against Japan. And Stimson also wanted to be more and more hostile or possibly even start the war with Japan before 1932, when he was working for President Hoover. Now, President Hoover, on the other hand, was also a very bright man, but he was a Quaker. And he told Stimson that he preferred a policy of peace, and peace, well, I don't know the exact quotation there, but peace could not be won by using the dogs of war. So Hoover was against the dogs of war. He didn't want to employ war as a
instrument
of politics. Mm.
And you know, isn't it interesting how Hoover has been, we've all learned, I did, that Hoover he was at fault for the whole depression and economic idiot, and it was all his fault. And then I've learned since all the good things that he's done, and it's just amazing, and what a rat this Roosevelt is, who supposedly was the savior of it all. So,
well, then by contrast, of course, Roosevelt was very much a man of war, even though he proclaimed himself to be a very peace-loving man. I've forgotten what occasion it was, maybe at Chautauqua in New York or at some point. He talked about he himself witnessing the First World War, and he saw all these bloody corpses on the ground and shattered anatomies and legs and arms lying about and so on. And that, according to Roosevelt, made such a deep impression upon him that he never, ever wanted to send American boys into war again. And he was saying that at the same time he was strongly preparing for war already, you know. Roosevelt succeeded in putting up this public relations and propaganda front of being a man of peace, allegedly, while he was actually preparing for war, you know, since 1933.
Well, okay. And what other evidence is there that he was preparing for war? Is there?
Oh, well, he whipped up armaments, especially with the Navy. He was a Navy man, as we all know, and he strongly bolstered the strength of the American Navy, you know, particularly against the Japanese.
Then yeah, it was Tansil, who made 3 points or something like that as to why Roosevelt was for war. And one was that he actually had a foreign policy of building up from the beginning of his presidency, 1933, of building up the armament and military strength of the United States for that purpose.
Right, that's true. Unfortunately, of course, it has not stopped with Roosevelt, you know. And so he succeeded in engineering Pearl Harbor, because he actually did engineer Pearl Harbor. And mm-hmm. he succeeded in having this catastrophe happen and embroiling the American people in the war, which the American people didn't want to do before that. And he knew he had to go through with Pearl Harbor to involve America in the European war and to start a second world war all over the globe, that he had to do that to drag the American people kicking and screaming into the war.
Are you saying that he was willing to have a world war in order to gain his aims, which were not necessarily to have a world war, but he had to have a big war in order to convince the American people to go to war at all?
Yeah, that's right.
And how interested was he in going to war in Europe? Was he more interested in the Pacific, in Japan, or was he equally interested in going to war with Germany and joining up with the Soviet Union and so on? Let's get into that part.
Well, he was active on both fronts.
Mm-hmm.
As a Navy man, he participated to some extent in this tradition of anti-Japan sentiment, which really all were very old, going back to the First World War and then to the Washington Naval Disarmament Conference of 1921-22, in which Japan was slighted in favor of the United States and Britain. And from then on, pretty much, Japan was one of the targets for military expansion, you know, of the United States into the Pacific. But as I just pointed out, Hoover did not want to do that, but then when Roosevelt came into power, then he stepped on the gas pedal and he was very anxious to get militarily involved against Japan and also against Germany, using the Soviet Union as a friend or possibly even as an ally, beginning with his Roosevelt-Litvinov Pact of 1933, when he recognized the Soviet Union and speculated, at least, that the Soviet Union and the expansion of the Soviet Union eastward from Siberia into Mongolia and in direction of Manchuria would bring Japan and the Soviet Union together, and there would be a war in the Far East between the Soviet Union and Japan, which would have been a benefit to Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
So he seemed to speculate along that line starting in 1933. Yeah.
So are you? Would you say that that it wasn't so much that Roosevelt was willing to help out his friends in England and also the French and so on, but mostly his friends in England and eventually Churchill, who he was so close to, but it was Roosevelt who was kind of trying to get England to get involved in a larger war.
That's
Germany.
That's right.
So the greater villain is between the two is Roosevelt. Greater villain than Churchill, or would you not put it that way?
I would say so. Also, considering the power equation, because speaking realistically, starting in 1914, when Britain and France, but especially Britain, had to rely on American aid to a very large extent and get loans from Wall Street, which at that time was dominated by, J.P. Morgan with the big mustache, who was also a friend of the British. By that time, 1914, when they got involved in war, mainly against Germany, Britain was already beginning to lose its empire. And then by 1917, when Woodrow Wilson declared war on Germany, he became the number one man in the First World War, the most powerful person on earth, actually. And people like Winston Churchill and Prime Minister Lloyd George and King George V and all those people were becoming secondary in power with regard to the United States. And Wilson was really the most powerful man on earth. And then when all the money, all the gold from London and from Paris flowing across the ocean towards New York and being deposited in the United States, then New York, starting in 1917, became, or even before that, became the primary focus of finance, the mistress of finance, so to speak, or if you want to say the lord of business for the entire world. And the British Empire had begun its steep downward plunge.
So well, what about the city of London? People like to say that it's still, London is still running the world.
Well, not today anymore, no.
No, that's not true, huh?
No, it's not true. It wasn't even true in 1939 because, for economic and for power political reasons, the United States had become the most powerful state, or the most powerful empire even on earth, you know, even in 1939. So when, I believe it was in June of 1939, King George VI and his Jewish wife came to New York to visit.
His Jewish wife? Who was
that? His wife was the Jewess.
Yes, which one? King George V. Let's see.
The sixth, father of Queen Elizabeth.
Queen Elizabeth's mother was Jewish?
Yes.
Was it Jewish?
By descent.
You mean that, what do we call her mother, Queen Mother?
Queen Mum, yeah, Queen Mum.
I didn't know that.
She was a Jewish descent. They always claimed that she was an Irish nobility, non-Irish, Scottish nobility, but of course, her father, Queen Mum's father was a multimillionaire. And as was the case in many countries, especially in Britain, if you were a multimillionaire, you could buy yourself a peerage. You became lord by donating so and so many, whatever, hundreds of thousands of pounds to the British government. Then they would make you lord, and that's what they did. And he bought.
So why did the British do that? Was it because they were doing it with everybody, and if Jews had the money, they just didn't discriminate between Jews and non-Jews? Why were they selling out their country to Jews?
Well, I don't know whether they saw it that way, but it was the usual practice of no matter what kind of descent you were, usually, sometimes it did make a difference, but usually, if you had enough money, you bought yourself a peerage, you know, you became a lord. And so even in the 19th century, second half of the 19th
so
century.
I have to pursue this for a minute. So they just figured they could give out as many lordships as they wanted. It didn't hurt anything in their eyes. It didn't matter. And it was a way to raise money.
Right.
Wow, that's just weird to me.
Well, that's the way Britain was run.
Yeah. No wonder they lost everything.
Right. So it actually was not a true aristocracy, but a plutocracy, you know, beginning with the first.
Well, were they always among themselves realizing and the difference between their true aristocracy and the plutocrats that were given titles?
Well, it might have been that way, yeah, for a generation or so. But after a while, you know, they merged and became part of the aristocracy, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. You can't do that.
And a palace or what have you, you know.
Yeah. Oh, that is very interesting. Yeah. Well, we have to stop for our break now. So we will continue as soon as we get back. Thank you, Dr. Westerly, and we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen.
You're welcome.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
For more about the Bushehr switch-on, let's now talk to journalist Afshin Ratansi. He's reported on Iran extensively. He's joining me now in London. Thanks very much for being with us here on RT. Now, amid the international concerns over Iran's nuclear program, how crucial do you think is Russia's participation in this particular project?
I think Russia's part has been absolutely crucial, and one should say it's a victory for Iran, but also a victory for Russian-Iranian relations. A kind of slap in the face to the P5 plus one when meetings resume in December the 5th, I think, because even Secretary of State Clinton said she wasn't that bothered, and we must remember she had envisaged a nuclear attack, a U.S. nuclear attack on Iran because of things like Bushehr.
Well, hang on, you say a victory for Russian-Iranian relations? Russia actually backed the last round of sanctions over Iran. Now, that was a kick in the teeth for Iran. They certainly weren't expecting that. So are you saying that actually relations are much better now?
I think that Moscow is playing a complex game here. It's true that the S-300 missiles are now, or defense system isn't going to be going to Iran. But nevertheless, the fact that the fuel rods from this reactor will be going back to Russia, this shows collaboration, and I'm sure raises eyebrows in the U.S. One must remember also the commentators in Washington were saying they wouldn't be able to do this with the sanctions regime.
But why is there still so much international concern over Iran's nuclear ambitions? After all, it's now a proposed anti-missile defense system for the whole of Europe involving Russia now, which we've just learnt about. Why? Because there's a perceived threat from North Korea and Iran. They wouldn't be doing that for fun, would they?
I think it's interesting that recently a German delegation were in Tehran saying this is basically all about politics. It's nothing to do with nuclear weapons or nuclear power or anything else. This is about the oil that Iran has. The United States wants it, and that's what it's all about. So the international community, well, when you look at the non-aligned movement and the big conferences in Tehran of non-aligned movement members, they all know what this is really about. And we now know that U.S. policy is failing miserably when it comes to isolating Iran as it seems to benefit from the sanctions. Some are even saying its economy is getting stronger because of the sanctions.
Well, you say, but some people will say that the sanctions have actually been hurting, and that Ahmadinejad, as a result of the last meeting between the Russian president and himself, he actually agreed to go back to the negotiating table. Is that because, actually, despite what you say, the sanctions are working?
I think there have been some surveys saying that homegrown industries are benefiting from the sanctions regime. As regards President Ahmadinejad and those sorts of talks, again, I think...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and of course, I'm here with Dr. Andreas Westerlake, who is has his PhD in political science, history, and also urban planning, and to do with architecture. But we're going to go now to talking about the lead-up and the entry of what has been termed World War II, and how that took place, and how Roosevelt played a part in that. So, where do you want to start with that, Dr. Westerling?
Well, I wanted to make a short, brief notice of the visit that King George VI and his wife paid to President Roosevelt in Hyde Park, and to the American officials of the American government in general, in which Roosevelt assured the English king that he would totally participate in the European war against Germany without declaring war, and that he would wage war against the German Navy in the Atlantic, North Atlantic, and South Atlantic, etc., etc., to help Britain out. and he made such promises that the king, the English king, who carried a briefcase with him, kept both promises and assurances in the briefcase of his and never lost it out of his sight, apparently for the duration of the entire Second World War. The English king considered those assurances so vital to Britain, possibly
absolutely
to the British Empire.
Without the United States and without all of Roosevelt's constant promises, it's yeah. very clear that Britain would have worked out a treaty, a peace with Germany, wouldn't they? I mean, they had to, and they would have. The reason they kept hanging on was because of Roosevelt.
Right. That was the main factor, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, another thing was the role of the super ambassador, Roosevelt's good friend, Bullitt, who had a very long history before and after Roosevelt. He appointed Bullitt, for instance, ambassador to Moscow in 1933-34, when Soviet Union was recognized by the United States and all that. And then Bullitt was also made ambassador extraordinary for Europe, and he went around strengthening the backbone, as they put it, of the war parties, especially in Poland,
mm-hmm.
and in France, and in England, and also blackmailing them, saying that, well, if you're not tough against Germany now, say 1939 or 1940, then when things get worse for you, we're not going to help you, you know. And so he blackmailed his governments and his states into being more ferocious and more militaristic than they wanted to be.
Are you saying that FDR or the United States recognized the Soviet Union in 1933, that it was FDR that did that?
Right, that's what it did.
The Soviet Union had not been recognized by the United States
right.
until then.
That's right.
Oh, my.
Not officially.
Oh, my. What was his reason for doing that?
Well, partially financial or economic, maybe, because people like Ford had already established factories in the Soviet Union, and so perhaps Roosevelt, on one hand, thought that he might aid American the American economy by having stronger relations with his communist power. But the main reason actually was that Roosevelt wanted to bank on Stalin and bank on the Soviet Union in Roosevelt's fight against Japan or against the Japanese Empire.
Oh, that's right.
And his fight against Germany in Europe.
Was he already foreseeing the fight against Germany in 1933?
Well, probably to some extent. As we tried to say before, Roosevelt was a very crafty politician,
mm-hmm.
and he was engaged in everyday politics in the United States, which at that time, of course, was even more more severe, and because of the Great Depression.
What was the press and the political reaction to Roosevelt's recognition, full recognition of the Soviet Union? Was there any, or is it just nothing?
Well, some of them, the so-called left liberals or so on, were in favor of it, but others, like say the right wing of the Republican Party, was aghast, and they didn't want to participate in this kind of
So it was controversial. It was controversial.
Yes, it was.
Time.
Yes, it was. Another thing was, there was the famous German Jewish, of all places, German Jewish economist by the name of Alois Schumpeter. He came from Vienna. It was Alois Schumpeter. He had taught at the University of Bonn on the Rhine in world economy and so on. Then he wanted to become professor at the University of Berlin, which of course would have been a great honor. But he didn't get the job because he was not a socialist. And at that time, before 1933, Berlin and Prussia was run by the Social Democratic Party. so he received a call to Harvard, and he went to Harvard, so he taught economics at Harvard. And despite being a Jewish, he could see both a political and economic dimensions of Roosevelt's policy, and Schumpeter was strongly opposed towards Roosevelt's cocketeering, you know, playing up to Stalin, playing up to the Soviet Union as a friend or as an ally in the struggle against Japan and Germany. And Schumpeter thought it would be a lot more intelligent in many ways, also intellectually and culturally and historically, and especially politically and economically, be more intelligent to rely on Japan and Germany to as counterweights against the Soviet Union, which even under Stalin, who strongly built up Russian nationalism and Russian industrialism and heavy industry and armaments industry and all that, despite that fact, Stalin still was working for the world revolution. He had not left his days of communist revolution ever behind. He just postponed it, and after, apparently his plans being after he dominated or possibly even conquered Europe, then after that he'd be able to introduce a world revolution to Britain and to the United States. But yes, Roosevelt didn't see it that way, but Schumpeter did, because Schumpeter was more intelligent and he could see more deeply than Roosevelt.
You really think that Roosevelt just couldn't even understand that, or he just didn't care, maybe?
He didn't care.
Look, that
didn't
far. He only cared about his time and what he was
right.
going to accomplish.
Right. He didn't care. He just was, you know, being a crafty politician and lying to everybody, more or less.
Yeah. So you were saying, before I interrupted you for that detour.
The thing is, one thing that happened later on in 1940, in June of 1940, when Hitler was victorious in the West, in his fight mainly against France, and the British were congregated in Dunkirk trying to flee to England, he refused to send his tanks in there to imprison those British soldiers. There were something like 330,000 British soldiers and about 8,000 French soldiers waiting to cross the channel to England.
Yeah, that's a very famous story.
Right.
And there are those who say that Hitler made his great mistake there, and I'm not necessarily of that opinion.
Well, he did. I would say he did, because he wanted to, in his mind anyway, he saw himself as a great victor in the European war. He now dominated the continent of Europe. And he wanted to, Hitler wanted to preserve the British Empire, which was already crumbling anyway, wanted to preserve the British Empire as a counterweight, on one hand, towards the Soviet Union, on the other, towards America. So it's a great global power to counteract Roosevelt on one hand and Stalin on the other.
And do you think that if Hitler had made that decision and had succeeded with Dunkirk, that the British would have, capitulated? Or what do you think? Do you think that Germany could have taken
Churchill,
over even that and managed it all?
Churchill would have been forced to sue for peace, because he would have had almost no soldiers, you know? Of course, the Navy would still have been there, but there was not enough.
Okay.
And Churchill would have been forced to sue for peace. And the Peace Party in Britain, which was quite strong at that time, including former King Edward VIII, who married Mrs. Simpson, he and many others, of course, were in favor of an understanding with Germany.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, Churchill, backed by various other interests.
Would you say Jewish interests?
That very definitely, yes.
Okay. Well, so then at that point, Hitler forgot that he did make a comment one time that he forgot he was a revolutionary, but I don't think it was about this particular instance, that he stopped being revolutionary enough and became too conservative in his thinking, still hoping to have this joint business going on with Britain as it was. Yeah.
Right. We could only imagine, you know, what Napoleon the First would have done in that circumstance if he had the British on the run. Of course, he would have imprisoned them all and then invaded England. You know,
I think Hitler was concerned that he didn't have the manpower or the armament power or a lot of power to do that, and he said that the government and that naval fleet and all of that would take off for Canada, and he would be left with the island and having to feed and take care of all those people. And then he said that Soviet Union was threatening at that time, he felt, very much with their world revolution plans. If Germany was all tied up there with Britain, he probably didn't have the faith in the peace party or the right wingers in Britain that you have and a lot of people have today. I think he may not have had, you know, trusted that they were going to carry it all on.
Yeah, quite possibly. But another mistake that he committed was when he met Franco on the French-Spanish border at Hendaya, in the Bay of Biscay. In June of 1940, Franco wanted to attack Gibraltar, because after all, Gibraltar is part of Spain, you know. It was stolen by the British in the course of their colonial expansion. And so Franco wanted to conquer Gibraltar, and they could have done it with German help. But again, Hitler was against that, because on one hand, he wanted to preserve the power of the British Empire as a counterweight against the United States and against the Soviet Union. And on the other hand, he also knew that once the Spaniards had Gibraltar, the French and the Spaniards were getting into each other's hair over North Africa, about Morocco, about mm-hmm. which they had many colonial disputes for a long time. So Hitler didn't want to do that, but it was a fateful mistake again, because...
Well, I thought that Hitler did want to do that thing with Gibraltar, and that Franco was not willing to do it with his forces. He wanted Germany to provide everything for him, something like that, and they couldn't.
The Spaniards by themselves would have been too weak to do that, but with German help, they would have done it.
Well, I understand
and
that
Franco wanted
to do it all.
Well, of course, it would have involved Spanish-German cooperation, you know. But the main effort certainly would have been done by Germany. But with the German dive bombers and all that, they could have reduced Gibraltar. And then if that had happened, then Hitler would have been able to strangle British supplies to North Africa, then he would have been able to take Malta also, which is just off Sicily, and he would have been able to help Mussolini in his strange war in North Africa against the British, and possibly they would have conquered Egypt and Syria and expanded into Iraq, because at that time the Iraqi nationals were rising against British domination, and then Germany would have had easy access to the oil fields of Iraq, you know, possibly even of Iran, if all that would have been done. You know, of course, it wasn't done, so it didn't happen.
It just goes to show that he really was not looking to be a world conqueror. He wasn't too thrilled with the idea of having all of this territory, conquering all of this and having to administer it and keep it going, even though there you can see the advantages to it, but that was not what he ever intended.
That's
and
right.
So maybe it was difficult to take on such huge
tasks.
Challenges like tasks. Yes,
right.
Tasks.
Because after all, the German army, despite the great victories that they won in Europe, the German army, or the German armed forces in general, including the Navy and even the Air Force, were quite weak compared
yes.
to the
Yes, and there, I think another thing is that he trusted his German military. He trusted his German soldiers, but he knew he constantly had trouble with others. Like, they had enough trouble with the Italians, accomplishing what they set out to do properly in the German sense of you know, what they think of as accomplishment. And then he said that he didn't want to have anything to do with getting involved with Franco. You know, I think
That's
he
right.
wanted to be able to attack Gibraltar, but he didn't want to get tangled up with Franco.
Right.
Franco's forces. And so all these things were considerations, and it's kind of like when you say what he should have done, it's kind of like in an ideal world if everything had gone well. But he was
right.
always
exactly
seeing all
true.
The problems, you know.
Right. And the thing is that Hitler did not seek world domination. He did not want to rule the world.
No.
Everything but that.
Yes.
He was envisioning a multipolar world, so-called, in which there would be a British Empire and German domination of the continent of Europe mm-hmm. and the United States in America and possibly the Soviet Union in the East, even though he was probably thinking about attacking it already. And then along came Molotov's visit to Berlin in October of 1940. Molotov, who was the new foreign commissar of the Soviet Union, went to Berlin, and he demanded, for one thing, Constantinople, Dardanelles, and the Bosporus,
mm-hmm.
the Straits, the Turkish Straits, and
on the other hand,
he also demanded a Soviet base in southern Scandinavia.
That brings us back to dear old Roosevelt and his desire to crush Germany and Hitler.
Yeah, it was very short-sighted.
It was, as we see today, what's happened. But what was the reason, again, for his being, did he just develop this competitive kind of hatred for Hitler and the Germans over the time of, you know, being involved in this? Because, like you say, he wasn't that intelligent, and he was very crafty and kind of maybe envious or something, or he just wanted to get the bet, you know, he wanted to come out on top. Or do you think it was something deeper than that?
Well, at least to some extent, he continued his, shall we say, distrust of Germany, starting with Teddy Roosevelt around before the First World War already. Because let's remember that Teddy Roosevelt thought that's one reason why I said he was mentally unbalanced. But he thought that the German Navy, which at that time was quite powerful, even though not as powerful as the British Navy, would come by the American East Coast and then just reduce the eastern cities, like, say, Boston, New York, Baltimore, and so on, to rubble by shooting them to pieces. You know, it's ridiculous. They would have never, first of all, the British would have never allowed them to get into the North Sea, to get into the North Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And they never had that desire to go to North America and start bombarding the eastern seacoast. It was ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But they showed the attitude of Teddy Roosevelt and his friends and many of the eastern plutocrats that they feared Germany as a competitor, mainly an economic competitor on the world market, but also as a kind of a, strong military power, including Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, and various other people try their best to make Germany smaller, to diminish the role of Germany, first of all, in Europe and worldwide. So, to some extent, Franklin Roosevelt continue that tradition, you know,
mm-hmm.
which was to some extent independent of world Jewry. Well, I would say that despite his allegations or his claim to be a man of peace, Roosevelt was anything but a man of peace, but he was very not outspoken, but a very direct and active man of war. He brought about, really, the worsening of the Second World War after the December attack on Pearl Harbor, which he engineered beforehand. And this kind of traumatic experience of another power attacking the United States, even though it was in Hawaii, which at that time was not really truly part of the United States, but this traumatic experience was such that with the proper propaganda after 1945, with Truman shifting the focus towards the Soviet Union, which of course was much more powerful, and to some extent communist China, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the American people have been kept in a constant state of hysteria, of wartime preparations, of invading other countries, the way that Barnes and Tansel and so on point out in their great classic book of 1952-53. Only it's become much worse since 1953, that events, traumatic catastrophes like 9/11 in New York actually turn on their heads, and that there's a global offensive has been kept going by the American power elite, by the ruling class, which of course is mainly identified with Wall Street. So the American people have really been preyed upon by Wall Street and by their own government, telling them lies and twisting the truth and using the American people as pawns in global power politics, period.
An excellent way to end, Dr. Wesley. Our time is up. This has been an outstanding program for which I thank you very much and look forward to more.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
To our listeners, thank you too for joining us. Come back again next week. I'm Carolyn Yeager, saying good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.